All right, what I would like to do today is to go ahead and give you the pre-lab for the next experiment in our cation anion identification sequence. You have the anion lab that you're going to be finishing up today. How many of you already finished the anion lab? Okay, just a couple of you. So that's why I wanted to move on, though, to the cation lab, because there are some people that had completed it and some of you that are probably close to completing it. I also have heard that later on in the sequence, there's some portions of it that are a bit more difficult, and so we might want a bit more time. But I want to give you a sort of overview of what you're going to be doing, because I was trying to be nice for the morning section. I didn't require the pre-lab. I never did send anything out over the weekend to say that you had to have that next pre-lab done, because I thought everybody would be too panicked about studying for the exam. But I ended up causing a little bit of panic and chaos in the lab, and this has just demonstrated to me why I really do need to make sure that everybody does a pre-lab, because even if the directions are fairly simple, there was enough confusion that I think it kind of defeated the purpose of getting ahead of schedule a little bit. So I want to talk about the general scheme that you're going to be doing, what this separation scheme is, and then I'll talk about the specific reactions that you're going to be doing today. I know that you're in the same boat, likely as Section 1, where maybe you didn't prepare your pre-lab. Maybe you heard from them what happened this morning, and so if you had any time or energy left after the exam, maybe some of you did start reading. If not, after I get done with my pre-lab, even if it takes you a while, read through the directions a few times so you do know exactly it is what you are doing. Because we do have a Wednesday in lab to complete the cation experiment. That's the day we were supposed to do it. What I'll likely do is do the pre-lab lecture for even the next lab that day, but then give you the rest of that lab time to complete whatever we've started so far. So let me tell you a little bit about this cation sequence that we're going to be doing. A lot of what we are doing is generating precipitates or redissolving precipitates from solution. That's in fact the entirety of what this first set of reactions is. There is a redox reaction that is involved, but it ends up generating precipitates, so it ends up being pretty much the same thing, that we have precipitation or dissolving of solutions going on. And what we're going to do is there's a series of tests whereby we can take a group of unknown ions and be able to divide them up into different categories. And today's lab is a good one to start with because it gives you a perfect example of how we can do that kind of separation. The main ingredient, you could say, that we're using for today's lab is hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid is not going to react with most metal ions because most metal ions are soluble in the presence of chloride. But there's three notable exceptions that I think came up in the last lab lecture that maybe we had talked about. Do you remember what those three ions are? So I know I haven't made us yet memorize the rules, and I still don't know if we're going to memorize all those solubility rules or not, but it's useful for this first one, where chlorides are normally soluble except in the presence of silver, mercury, or lead plus 2. So imagine that you had an unknown set of cations. If you were to react it with a source of chloride, well, most of the ions would just stay in solution. But then you would have a precipitate form if you had one of those three ions that I just identified. Then, as you're going to see, there's a series of tests we can do where we can distinguish between those three different ions. So it's like we've created a little group that we're going to work on, and then all the other ions will be further separated. And that's exactly the logic of the scheme. So we're at what's called group A, which is that three ions, that set of three ions I just named, silver, mercury, and lead. So let me draw a flow chart for this portion of the lab. If you do go back to look at your lab text, you'll see they do give you flow charts that are very similar. And I just want to talk about the logic of this flow chart, because if you keep referring back to it, it might help you in the lab procedure. Because as I said, you're going to be forming precipitates, you're going to be dissolving things, and it helps to know what the purpose of that is if you get a little bit lost in your procedure. So you imagine that you were given an unknown mixture of ions. In reality, you're not going to be given just one mass sample that you have to test, because let's say something happens along the way and your sample gets ruined. This is a multi-week experiment, and so we don't want to have to start over again. And so in reality, what will happen is that you'll be given unknowns that are just for that local group, you could say, of ions we're testing for. So today's samples will only contain silver, mercury, and lead. But let's say that it was more general than that. We had this whole set of unknown ions that we then reacted with hydrochloric acid. As I had indicated, there's going to be a precipitate that'll form with certain ions, and then I'll abbreviate it as super on here, but that stands for supernatant, the solution that is left over, that which does not precipitate. So I'll put others here, meaning those are other ions besides the three that we're isolating today, and then there'll be other reactions that you do where you branch off further and further from that point. From today's lab, we are testing just those three I keep naming. Notice that mercury, I'm writing as a dimer, which I believe I introduced that term last time. So two mercuries that are stuck together, automatically then, since each one is plus one individually, this dimer is plus two as the combo. Silver, mercury plus one, and then lead plus two. They have different solubilities in water. And it turns out that if you boil water, that you increase the solubility of most ionic compounds, and particularly the lead chloride becomes just a little bit soluble. So that brings up one important point about this lab. The quantities that are listed in the experiment are rather important because they've been designed for those different precipitation or dissolving tests to just work just right. So if you had too much excess or too little of a reagent, it might cause you to have a false reaction, meaning you get a precipitate where you're not supposed to, or you fail to get a precipitate where you are supposed to. So in this case, though, if you heat it up in water, the lead chloride will redissolve while the other two ions will stay in solution. So silver chloride, mercury chloride, too insoluble to precipitate or to dissolve. The lead would dissolve, but of course we don't know if we really have lead. We're just talking about the fact it could dissolve. But after we dissolve it, that means we should do a positive confirmation test. In this case, if we add potassium iodide, then if we get a precipitate, that means, yes, we have lead. And that precipitate is a very characteristic, very bright yellow. If there's no precipitate, if all you have is just that supernatant, well, then there is no lead there. Gesundheit. So this is the first sequence that you follow. You react it with hydrochloric acid first. You should get a precipitate. You're going to do a wash of that precipitate. And the purpose of that wash is if there's anything that maybe should have precipitated but didn't precipitate but is still stuck to that precipitate, if it's carried forward in the rest of the reactions, then that might be a way that you get a false positive. You get results that you're not supposed to. So after you form the precipitate, you are going to add water to it and then get rid of that water again so that, as I said, you don't have anything extra going along for the ride. You'll then heat up a water bath. You can check out hot plates in order to heat that water bath up. You will be given plastic tubes, or you already have those as part of the kit. And yes, the plastic will survive the boiling water. We were keen enough to make sure that this was a plastic that was compatible with boiling water. I only say that because this morning there were a lot of people that asked me, is this okay, is this okay? Yes, the plastic tubes are going to stand up to the water bath. At that point, if there's lead in your solution, it'll go into solution, and then you have this precipitate that you're going to carry on with separately. Now here's another part that's going to be a potential point of confusion. We don't, in reality, have any mercury in our samples because mercury is a toxic enough metal that we made the decision that we would leave it out of our tests. There's so many other ions that we're testing for. One little ion being left out isn't going to hurt us enormously. You're still going to act as if the mercury is there, though, because part of the mercury test also gets at testing whether or not there's silver there. So you're going to go ahead and do that step, even though, as I said, in reality, there's no mercury. What we do is to add ammonia, which, let's roll back to Chem 1B for a moment. Ammonia is actually a gas, but when you bubble it through water, it becomes a solution. Just like hydrogen chloride, the pure compound is also itself just a gas. But it instantly dissociates when you bubble it through water and we get hydrochloric acid. So ammonia, when we put it into water, becomes ammonium hydroxide. So I haven't walked over there to see how the bottles are labeled, but it's very possible that that's might what be written on there because that's what we have in solution. So same compound, in other words. It's just ammonia is the pure substance, which doesn't exist in solution, and it hydrolyzes in water to form ammonium hydroxide. That ammonium hydroxide does two things. With silver, it causes a redox reaction, which at the moment I don't care that we memorize that redox reaction. But in the context of the experiment, having a precipitate like that means that yes, we had that mercury ion present. So the precipitate is some black solid that is formed in the process of that redox reaction. You should not see a precipitate at this point because you're not going to have mercury. The silver is insoluble if you have chloride, but there's something that happens with ammonia that we're going to be also studying now that we're past buffer solutions. When silver chloride is reacted with ammonia, it forms an ion that includes more than just the silver. The silver, in fact, becomes bound to two different molecules. Yes? No, I started to erase it, but I didn't obliterate it enough. There you go. So this ion, it's got two ammonias that are attached to the silver to make a larger complex. In fact, that's exactly what it's called, a transition metal complex. That complex ends up now being water soluble, where the silver by itself was not. These ammonia are what we could call ligands. It's a term that we'll get later on. And these are molecules that sometimes reversibly attach to a transition metal, sometimes irreversibly attached. Different ligands can have different affinities with metals. That's somewhat related to how the fact that we're able to breathe, because you might know that oxygen is carried through the bloodstream by being transported on hemoglobin at iron centers. So there's a transition metal complex involved in that as well. So the chloride will still be around. It's a counter ion because the ammonia, you notice, starts out neutral. So even once it attaches to the silver started as plus one, it ends up as plus one. So it didn't change that charge, but it did make the complex soluble, which is why if you had silver, when you did that first reaction with hydrogen chloride, you're going to get a precipitate, which now should dissolve. So in the supernatant, if it's there, we have silver. But like the lead test, just because we had a precipitate dissolve doesn't automatically mean it's silver. In real life, yes, it does, because I already told you there's no mercury. But we're pretending here that this is the flowchart we would follow in the general case. So how do we know if there's silver? Add nitric acid. Because the nitric acid reacts with the ammonia to neutralize it. If you neutralize the ammonia, it no longer can be attached to the silver. That means the silver is exposed to the chloride that's sitting around already in solution, which means you're going to get a precipitate again.
So if you have a precipitate, that means, yes, there is silver. But if there's no precipitate, then there's no silver.
So let me step one more time through this flow chart, because this kind of logic is what's going to be used in all the rest of these cation sequences that we will be doing. And I guess I should write up here that this is group A, as listed in your lab text. So we start out with a group of ions. We separate three of them because they're the three that don't stay soluble if there's chloride present. So we react with hydrochloric acid to pull those three out of solution. I will be giving you unknowns later in class, and it will not, as I said, contain mercury, but it might contain silver, or it might contain lead, or it might contain both silver and lead. You then have to distinguish between those ions, and the first way we do it is to heat that solution up to the boiling point of water. That will cause the lead to dissolve, which then you quickly separate that out from the precipitate. There is a possibility, maybe, that you would have a precipitate reform, but then to make sure that you really do have the lead, what you would do is add potassium iodide, which makes lead iodide, bright yellow solid. Even if that tests positive, then you have to wonder, is there silver around? So we're going to follow the same route we would for mercury, for mercury, because we want to see if that precipitate re-dissolves. Suppose something goes wrong and not all the lead dissolves. So that's why we're also still following this procedure to make sure we pull out just the silver. So when you add the ammonia, that should dissolve the silver again due to the formation of this transition metal complex. You get that out from any precipitate that there might be around to make sure you just have the solution. And then to confirm that you've got silver there, you add nitric acid because that neutralizes the ammonia and the silver then falls back out of solution. Now let me talk about waste disposal and safety a little bit. Currently, we've got a ton of waste over in the fume hood over here. And so I need to coordinate to see if we need to move that somewhere else. But temporarily then, our waste bottles are back here in the back of the classroom. One of them either has the experiment name on it, the group A cations, or it has things like silver and lead listed as waste. The other one should either say anions on it, or if it doesn't, then it should mention nitrate, oxalate, all those different anions you had tested, and should not mention the silver and the lead. So you can know which one is which by checking the label. Do check the label instead of just on autopilot going and dumping your waste back there, because we have anions and we have cations, and you put the two together and you get a reaction. So we do need to worry about waste segregation. As far as safety, we do have silver that you potentially are using. Your unknowns might have silver. Didn't somebody here end up with a silver nitrate stain, or was that the morning section? I think that was the morning section someone got one. Anybody in here want to admit to getting a silver nitrate stain yet? Note the keyword, admit. Okay. So just be careful of the silver samples. When I hand out your unknowns, you might want to have gloves on just in case. These are all sealed off, but in case somehow that plastic breaks while you're handling it, then you don't want to mess on your hands, literally. In case you don't get around to testing this unknown today, I would like you to go ahead and take an unknown sample, go ahead and store it in your locker kit so I don't have to worry about keeping track of who has or has not gotten an unknown sample. In other words, I don't want to have to figure out a way for me to store the unknown samples. So I will pass those out at some point later in the lab, because one of the sets, they still need to be prepared. It may even be possible, due to being kind of late in the day for me to warn them, that we might not get all of the unknown samples today. But as I said, then you have next time where those of you who get to that point, you'll easily finish on Wednesday. So that was safety disposal. Did anyone have any questions? I am going to be putting the procedure up on the computer here, so if you don't have it with you, I also have my copy that I'll run, go get, and put out in the front here. You can see that I have left for you the solid samples from the anions lab. Hopefully you all wrote down both your sample number and the color of each sample, because unfortunately blue, green, and yellow number 11, for example, are not all the same thing. Each of the colors are a different sequence of ions. So if you only wrote down numbers and you didn't write down colors, you're going to have to start those tests for your unknown over again, unfortunately. If you did write those numbers down, well, we do have the same samples available for you to be able to continue. And then if you could, once or if I do make those unknowns available for the cation lab, if you would go ahead and grab one just to go ahead and store in your locker kit, which, again, just in case somehow that plastic breaks, you might want to store that unknown sample in a beaker. So if there's not any questions, this is a rather short lecture today. Let's go ahead and get started.